Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now we're in depth on the limits of free speech.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
That's white nationalist Richard Spencer last month at a rally as some in the crowd are giving the Nazi salute. When Spencer showed up last week at Texas A&M to tell the crowd that, quote, America belongs to white men, he faced protesters and harsh critiques from the campus leadership. But Spencer and his supporters found fresh momentum during the last months of the general election, particularly online. And that's prompted renewed consideration of where the limits are to free speech. Law professor Amos Gior, who's going to join us in a couple minutes, recently wrote, "We need a national conversation that asks, what are the limits of tolerating hate?" Today, what the law on the First Amendment currently says, what it means, and why some are arguing the tolerance for hate speech has gone too far. As our guests join us this morning, here's what I'd like you to think about. Are we putting the targets of hate speech at too much risk because we tolerate it, even if the threat of violence isn't explicit? What's the answer to this when social media gives haters an ever more powerful platform on which to spread their hate speech? So I want you to think about whether we as a society, as a culture, are putting the targets of hate speech at too much risk because we tolerate hate speech in the pursuit of free speech. And what's the answer to this when social media gives haters such a platform, such a powerful platform? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis at nprnews.org/live. I'm on Twitter. I'd like you to think about it and tweet me at Carrie NPR. Our guest today, Soraya Shamali, is director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and an activist on gender and politics. And she joins us today. Soraya, I'm sorry, I don't know where you are this morning, but it's good to have you here.
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Thanks very much for being with us. And Amos Giora is with us. He's a professor at the University of Utah, and he's joining us from Tel Aviv. Amos, I'm really glad you were able to get in on the show. Thank you.
I thank the pilot who arrived on time.
Okay, I know you just went through customs. So,
right.
Hey, Amos, let me ask you, what prompted you to begin considering this and making the argument that maybe there are some limits needed here?
That I was reading here and reading there and increasingly aware, I think like many of us, about a change in tone and tenor of the conversation in the United States, whether in traditional media, traditional radio like your shows, and I think more disturbing than that, the whole online issue. And I felt the need to at least suggest and modestly suggest that given what I see as the amping up of hate speech on the internet, that at least to ask ourselves as a society whether we need to reexamine the limits of speech on the internet, given that it's, you know, it's anonymous, it's unfiltered, there are no restrictions. And at what point does hate speech morph into speech that potentially endangers the target, given, again, the anonymity that the internet provides the posters? And I just felt there was a need to write the op-ed. It was published in the Salt Lake Tribune last Sunday. There were, in the Salt Lake Tribune, there were over 300 talkbacks in a robust, vigorous debate, which is great. Unfortunately, that morphed into postings on one of the neo-Nazi websites where the talkbacks became beyond vitriolic. They became, from my perspective, threatening with respect to me.
Wow.
And that, to me, just, you know, proved the point of the dangers of unlimited free speech on the internet. It's not particularly pleasant, I must say, to have posters making threats against me in particular.
Wow. Soraya, when the Supreme Court decided Brandenburg in 69, if I'm right, no one knew what social media was. So what I'm wondering about is, has the platform that, as Amos suggests, of social media and the and the megaphone that that gives hate speech. Do you think that's changed the way we should think about the limits of free speech?
Certainly. I mean, I think that there was no way when that ruling was made to understand the scope and amplification qualities of the medium itself. And I don't just mean in the moment, in the example that Amos just gave, which really has been going on now for a decade. We're seeing a particularly politicized efflorescence, but for women, for black people, what he just described has been par for the course of living online. And so I think that one of the issues we don't think about, for example, is the staying power of what exists online. So while we see these things explode in this way right now, the fact is that they also have the quality of sitting there and being leveraged later. So, for example, the video, The Innocence of Muslims, had actually been posted months before, causing a sort of global cataclysm.
Call here from Tia in Prior Lake. Hi, Tia. How are you thinking about this morning?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My thoughts on hate speech are that can they be regulated? Should they be regulated? Yes. I think that the platform has given people basically free-for-all to say whatever they want. I think a lot of ways people are refuting that and fighting against that is they're contacting employers via Facebook and via Instagram if they're listed, letting them know, copying and pasting and holding people accountable for the things that they are saying on social media. There's a lot of Blue Lives Matter rhetoric and white nationalist Christian rhetoric that's basically, you know, the front, the fore, the face of racism. And it's not that it's spreading, it's that it's in your face now. And that's what social media has done. It's letting you see how part of America really does feel about minorities and people of lower income.
Yeah, Tia, thanks very much for the call. And yet, Amos, as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking, for as disgusting and as vitriolic as some of this speech is, the idea of curbing this is really against everything, as long as it isn't explicitly calling for violence, is everything that that seems opposed to what we honor in a democracy.
I agree with you 100%. But when the founding fathers created the First Amendment, the world they knew was very different from the world we know today. When the Supreme Court in Brandenburg in 1969 held what it held, it was a very different world than it is today. And while I have enormous respect for free speech, I understand the importance of free speech. At some point, that tolerance of free speech morphs into a paradigm where that enables hate speech and threatening speech. And one of the points I tried to make in the op-ed was that as much as we need to be concerned about protecting the speaker, we also need to be concerned about protecting the potential target of that speech, which raises perhaps a more philosophical question about to whom is a duty owed.
Right.
And so while, yes, I have great reverence for the First Amendment and free speech, I don't have any reverence whatsoever for anybody who posts direct threats, for instance, in this case, against me. And I'm obviously, as the other individuals are mentioning, I'm obviously not the first, and I have no doubt I'm not the last. And it's ironic, you know, Carrie, that I'm sitting here in Tel Aviv. I remind all of us that 21 years ago, there was terrible incitement here in Israel against then Prime Minister Rabin. Incitement, until on a Saturday night in November, Yigal Amir assassinated Prime Minister Rabin. So at some point, the tolerating of unmitigated and unlimited free speech clearly has the potential to transition into, again, hate speech, which then transitions into acts of violence. Precisely because we tolerated that speech. And then the question really does become, what are the limits of free speech? And when do we say, wait a minute, that's incitement against violence?
Let me bring Margaret Russell in. She's a professor of law at Santa Clara University, and she's joining us from Boston. And Margaret, you've had a chance to listen to a bit of this. Tell me what you're hearing here and what you think.
Well, I think that I agree with the previous speakers that the harm of hate speech is enormous. And I even think back to being in high school and getting a piece of U.S. postal mail, which was go back to Africa, which was directly targeted anonymously against me. So I think it's definitely should be addressed. But my concern as a constitutional law professor is really with the question of who does it best. And I think on the Internet, Internet service providers are the best purveyors of those that kind of decision-making. The problem with leaving it to the government, frankly, is, first of all, with any liberty, who is in the government, right? We're assuming that it would be some benign person who would have the same idea of what hate speech
exactly.
is as you and I. But in the last couple of months, I've read articles that have called the KKK a hate group and have called Black Lives Matter a hate group. So the problem of who is in government and giving the government the power to define that is very problematic. Secondly, is one of who they would decide to prosecute. And the history of the First Amendment, even before Brandenburg, way back to the 19-teens, really, with the earliest kind of speech prosecutions and espionage prosecutions, is that they single out political minorities who are called hate groups, but aren't necessarily hate groups within our definition. So I think the kind of hate speech that you played at the beginning and that we're talking about is very powerfully harmful, but there are tools already to address them. And frankly, if the speech at the Trump rally was not heard in public, I have no doubt that it would occur in private, underground, and would still lead to the kind of damage that we're talking about.
Margaret, we're getting a lot of static on your line. We're going to call you back. And in the meantime, if you've just tuned into the conversation, we're talking about the idea of limits on free speech. There are limits when hate speech actually demands violence or asks for violence. But otherwise, we have wide parameters on the kind of speech that we're willing to tolerate. And we're talking this morning about how the presence of social media may have changed that and whether it is time to put more limits on free speech. And we've got a variety of different arguments here, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. Are we putting the targets of hate speech at too much risk because we're tolerating this kind of speech? What's the answer to it when social media gives these haters an ever more powerful platform on which to spread their hate speech? Or do we have to take into consideration what Margaret just said about you may limit it in public, but you're probably not going to stop it in private? And what does that mean? What are the implications of that? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. And to someone in Winona who'd like to be anonymous, good morning.
Yes, hi.
Hi. What do you want to say about this?
Well, I kind of feel like when you go to start limiting hate speech, the people who talk a bunch of hate, I feel like start to get more vitriolic and angry about it. And also, too, if you're going to start limiting hate speech, you got to kind of start being fair and limiting progressive speech, too, which is also not going to be.
Well, I don't really understand the argument there. Why?
Well, because people may become offended, and I feel like what the difference between speech and a conviction, I think, are different. When you start saying I'm gonna do this to you, it's transitioned from the realm of speech into terroristic threats, which we already have protections against. When you start saying you can't say anything bad about X group,
mm-hmm.
then you know that kind of qualifies as hate speech.
Okay. Soraya, weigh that a bit and tell me what you think about that argument.
So I think that the caller points to a very real difficulty, which is that we don't have definitions for what constitutes hate speech, and we don't have definitions for what really constitutes what we think of as a true threat. And I agree with Professor Russell. The government shouldn't be making those decisions. I think that the situation we're in now, though, where social media companies who are indeed regulating our speech 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are also perhaps not the best option. And what we see over and over and over again is this idea that we have free speech online on these platforms and that the First Amendment is relevant. And it's not. It doesn't have a place, really. These are private corporations. They're making decisions that help their brands, mm-hmm. that grow their markets. And they don't have any legal obligations, really, ultimately. And that's very problematic. We have restrictions on speech in other public arenas. We have them in the workplace. We have them in schools. And that hasn't destroyed those spaces. Danielle Citrin makes a very good argument, as does Marianne Franks, that civil rights, these are civil rights issues, that we should be perceiving them in those ways and reconceiving the parameters that we're talking about.
Okay.
And I think that's valid. And the other thing, too, is as it pertains to hate speech, which hate I don't think is a particularly useful definition, a defining word.
What would you call it?
So there are lots of other theories regarding harm. Susan Benesch has a really good framework for thinking about dangerous speech. She has guidelines. When does speech go from what some people might call just words to actually being the kind of speech that causes a diffuse danger? It doesn't, you know, the way we define imminent harm is extremely narrow and perhaps not very helpful in a hyperlinked network of small world networks that can engage in ways that just didn't exist before.
Yeah, to Margaret and Amos, and I want you both to listen to a tweet here from Kevin who says, pamphlets on the corner were anonymous in 1789. How is that different? What constitutional principle allows limits on speech? Margaret, would you tackle that and what Soraya just said first?
Well, as far as the harm goes, of course, the reach of the harm now is much further than the pamphlet. But I do agree with the sense that the constitutional framework is really the same as before, which is that the government should not be trusted to limit the content of speech. The government also is, of course, free to have neutral reasons to regulate speech. And that when we give the government the power to define, they will probably get it wrong in ways that will be unevenly distributed among underrepresented groups.
And Amos, here's Kevin back again on Twitter, says, maybe I think Professor Giora is a threat to liberty and should be silenced. Who gets to decide?
So, interesting point. A couple of responses. One, if I may, Carrie, share with you and the viewers the one of the comments that was directed at me, and then we can discuss whether this was a threat. One of the posters wrote about the following: raise your hands if you want to see Amos's bloody scalp. That's not amorphous. That's not free speech. That's threatening speech. That's point A. Point B, Carrie, as you and I have discussed, I think previously, I have a book coming out called The Crime of Complicity, talking about the role of the complicity of the bystander, whether in the Holocaust or in contemporary society. I think that in this age of, I don't know any other term other than amped up speech that clearly morphs into threatening speech, all I try to say in the op-ed, and I stand by it, is that we need to ask ourselves whether we as a society are willing to tolerate the kind of, for instance, raise your hand if you want to see Amos's bloody scalp. Mm-hmm. That's threatening speech.
Yeah.
Whether it's Amos Giora or whether it's Kerry Miller or it's whether anybody else. I don't see why that should be protected speech. With respect to Kevin's interesting tweet, no, I have no intention whatsoever of being silenced. I have no intention whatsoever of the threateners silencing me. I will continue to speak. I will continue to write. But my speech will never be a threat to somebody's physical well-being. There is a huge difference. And it's precisely the somebody such as Kevin's tweet, which is, I'm not really sure what the intended purpose of it is, but there's an enormous difference between somebody weighing in, as I and others do, and then others posting whether or not you want to see Amos's bloody scalp. I really don't see the difference whatsoever. And to suggest that there's some kind of an equal between this and equal between that is to fundamentally miss the point of this enormously important conversation, which you're hosting.
Call here from Jordan in Mankato, Minnesota. Hi, Jordan. Thanks for waiting. How are you thinking about this?
I think I'd like to look at this in kind of a way of getting community involved more in policing these things. I don't think the government or a corporation would ever really make the right decision in every case, and the community certainly may not either. And if Facebook wants to take down blatantly hateful and vitriolic things, that's totally fine with me. But I think the community to rally around each other, circle the wagons and say, I'm not okay with you saying that to this person. Because if you've been on the internet for the past decade or more, this stuff has been there the entire time. It's just now coming to the surface, I think, with this year, especially. So I guess that's to sum it up, I would say, get community involved more because they're more likely to make the right decision more times than government or a corporation is. And that doesn't bring up the question of who's in power or who, what CEO thinks what.
Okay. Jordan, I appreciate that. I want to hear from Jonah in Mankato as well. And Jonah, you were saying more of a community response, less specific regulation. Is that right?
I'm more concerned with the battle of words back and forth, how when one person has a lack of compassion or empathy for a group, that our response is to have a lack of empathy for their freedom of expression. What seems most in need is a sense of solidarity with those who are underprivileged. I think the best response is not to try to fight violence with violence, to try to take someone's rights away, even if they're misused, but to express a solidarity and a willingness to suffer with those who are being oppressed, instead of trying to take someone's ability away to say something offensive, to be able to identify with the person they're offending and to help them to get a sense that even if people are disliked, they're never isolated, they're never marginalized.
Okay.
To always stand with the marginalized.
Margaret, to what you've heard from Jordan and Jonah here.
Yes, I agree that the best way is to be an ally, really, and to have the voice of the people speak out very strongly, rather than to give the government that power. If I might weigh in on Professor Amos's comments. First of all, it's absolutely outrageous and harmful what that person said, and I definitely empathize with you. I think I should mention that there is some precedent for prosecutions and also civil action for internet hate speech, and the one that's talked about the most was a civil action that resulted in over $100 million in damages, and it was anti-abortion groups that were targeting abortion providers on the internet, and they were doing so in a very direct and vicious way, in that they were listing their names and in some cases their home addresses, and then as each person was victimized by violence, they would cross out the name on the internet. Now, that's an example, like Amos's, in which if you can meet the framework of a criminal threat or a true threat, it is possible to hold someone accountable for speech over the internet, because it's more than speech. It's a threat.
Alex says on Twitter, I have friends who have tried suicide because of hate speech, but I worry whom those in power might mark as hate speech, i.e., Trump versus the media. Steph, off the page.
Doug DeDecker says, I agree with a former Justice Hugo Black that restriction of the First Amendment means no law can be passed to suppress free speech. Besides, with Steve Bannon down the hall from President Trump, I don't want the alt-right determining what is hate speech.
It's a conversation this morning on the idea of the limits to free speech. Soraya Shamali is with us. She's director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. Margaret Russell is a law professor at Santa Clara School of Law. And Amos Giora is with us, a law professor at the University of Utah. And we're reaching him this morning in Tel Aviv. Hearing some thoughts of yours this morning, I appreciate the way that you're considering all different sides of this and coming to us with some really good questions and comments. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, to the news now. I'm Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Donald Trump has chosen General John Kelly as the next head of the Department of Homeland Security. The Trump transition team made the announcement this morning, and it was expected. Meanwhile, Trump's top advisor, Kellyanne Conway, told the TV network Morning Shows this morning that ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson would be an attractive candidate as Secretary of State. Donald Trump is trying to cast new doubt on the CIA's conclusion Russia tried to interfere in the U.S. presidential election. The president-elect is tweeting today, it's very hard to determine who was doing the hacking. He adds that if his campaign had lost the election and, quote, we tried to play the Russia CIA card, it would be called conspiracy theory. Egypt's president says a suicide bomber caused Sunday's explosion that killed 24 Christians during mass at a Cairo chapel. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi identified the man by name today, saying he was 22 years old. He also says three men and a woman have been arrested in connection with that attack at the chapel adjacent to Cairo's St. Mark's Cathedral. A fire official says four children under the age of 10 have died in a house fire in Tennessee. Fire officials in Springfield say firefighters arrived within 4 minutes of getting the call early today and extinguished the blaze quickly, but found the children, ages 4, 7, 8, and 9, dead near the back of the house. Another child and his or her father were taken to a hospital. Two other children and their mother escaped unharmed. And the musical La La Land leads the Golden Globes nominations with 7, including Best Picture, Comedy, or Musical. Moonlight leads the field in the dramatic categories with 6 nominations, including Best Picture. The Golden Globes will be handed out January the 8th. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
On our Monday, All Things Considered, downtown Minneapolis was once a thriving retail hub. Today, it's home to numerous empty storefronts. I'm Tom Cran. That story and all the day's news. Join me weekdays here on Minnesota Public Radio News, starting at 3.
Hey, if you have to go do something like get back to work or run an errand and you can't listen to this whole conversation, you can find it on the podcast. What are people listening to right now? Our discussion last week on Donald Trump's cabinet, and my discussion with Nora McInerney on why small talk on big stuff just doesn't cut it. Find it all on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our listeners and by Fairview Health Services. They're focused on taking care of your health today so you can focus on tomorrow. You can learn more at fairviewstories.org.
Back to the conversation now this hour, and I am going to reserve a little bit of time at the end of the hour for the letters that I received about the Friday roundtable. I think it kind of applies to this idea that we're talking about free speech. So Steph and I will read just a fraction of the mail I got about the Friday roundtable. Back to the conversation this hour as we're talking about freedoms of speech and the First Amendment and potential limits on that. And I'm going to grab a call here from Mitch in Minneapolis. Hi, Mitch. What are you thinking about on this?
I just wanted to make a comment on there seems to be an issue with confusing criticism with hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, for example, if you criticize Islam, you're called a bigot or a Islamophobe. And I mean, I don't know how to fix that at all, but it seems we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater if we're trying to limit hate speech.
Amos, I know you know the legal application to this, but does Mitch have a point when we're talking about free speech?
Right. Yeah, he's totally right. I mean, I have no problem with me being critical of others and others being critical of me. I mentioned earlier, Carrie, that there are over 300 talkbacks to my op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune. That's exactly the point of an op-ed. And I welcomed and I embraced people's, whether they're criticizing my op-ed, they see weaknesses in my argument. That's the whole point of an open, vigorous, rigorous discussion. And I embrace that, and I'm happy to weigh in. I'm happy to be a participant in that. For me, the red flag is not an orange, or like not an orange card like in soccer, but a red card is when that morphs, I don't know any other word, morphs, transitions into speech that clearly is threatening speech. And I think that you know, we mentioned earlier, somebody mentioned the pamphlet in the corner. Yeah, absolutely. But the internet is far more than a corner. The internet is here, there, and everywhere. And you can't, once you post, you post. It's out there. And I think that we simply need to recognize that with all the positives of the internet, of which there are enormous positives, there are also potentially dangers associated with that. And the entire point of the op-ed, which I understand has caused, you know, this significant conversation, which is great, is whether or not the internet requires us to ask ourselves whether or not we need to take the First Amendment into consideration, reconsideration in the context of the internet, when our tolerance of free speech enables I know no other word other than haters who are only too happy to threaten somebody else. That for me is a very different paradigm than traditional tolerated free speech, which, again, I put this out there. Lord knows that my op-eds and my books, you know, there are people who are critical of it and critical of me, and that's fine. But not when it transitions into a clear threat. That for me is a very clear difference.
Amos, I really appreciate you spending some time with us from the airport in Tel Aviv. I'm going to let you go through customs. It's really good to have your views, and I think we can continue to discuss them. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. I appreciate that. Have a great day.
And you. Amos Giora is a law professor at the University of Utah and with us this morning from Tel Aviv. Margaret, to what Amos said there at the last.
Yes, well, I actually take the position raised by an earlier caller that speaking up and using our First Amendment rights in solidarity is much more important and actually much better than relying on the government to define what speech to censor. Hate speech is terrible. There are other legal remedies right now through which hate can be regulated if it is part of another crime. So the swastika on someone's property, right? That is graffiti, it's vandalism. If you have assault, but assault can be enhanced as an hate crime if there is bias attached to it. So I think that having separate standalone rules to ban speech is very problematic, and it's a good thought, but it'll wind up backfiring.
Soraya, your view on that?
So I completely agree on the front that the government shouldn't be involved, but the government right now is completely not involved, and we have this situation where basically internet service providers and social media companies are deciding what constitutes legitimate threats and safety. And that's also really problematic. In the case, for example, of bystander intervention, which we're saying people should engage in, different people have different rights to do those things without the threat of violence. So even as a woman writer, I know that almost inevitably when I write something about rape, I get threatened with rape, right? And I can write about the wage gap and I'll get threats. So the issue is someone at Facebook or maybe Twitter has to decide when that's legitimate. And we've had a good solid 10 years at least of making this argument that a threat of rape has to be treated seriously. And someone decides whether that's right or not. And the question is who makes that decision and on what basis and incorporating what norms. So we just saw during the election that tens of thousands of women formed secret Facebook groups. And that wasn't really because they wanted to, you know, trade Tupperware. It was because they felt pretty strongly that sharing their opinion in public would result in their harassment. And they felt that because that had been happening. And so bystander intervention assumes at a certain level that we can all engage in the same way without the same threats. And that's just not true. We have the incorporation of historic discrimination on the basis of race or religion or gender every day. So we need better mechanisms in these platforms, whether they are privacy mechanisms or multidisciplinary groups of people, diverse groups of people who are deciding how this speech can be defined.
Yeah, Soraya, I just want to add here, and I'm hoping that Steph Curtis will share this Salon post that you wrote on our social media channels, because you say about the fact that white supremacists motivate acts of violence against women, and you say it's also logical through this distorted lens of these supremacists that women who violate codes of conduct by becoming political actors and claiming male power are traitors, and violence against traitors is justified. That's kind of how that chain of logic works in the white nationalist, white supremacist side of this, right?
That's correct. I think when you see thousands of people at a Trump rally calling for Hillary Clinton to be locked up or shot, you really have to you can't say that's a lone wolf madman, right? We're talking about your neighbor, your dentist, your UPS driver, you know. And so how do you get to that point? And in the logic of white supremacists, women have a place, and that place is to reproduce white
white babies, right? And when women violate that, when white women violate that, there are serious punishments. And this isn't just obviously something that's happening in the U.S. I mean, we see this network of white nationalism that's global. And we also see violent acts against women politicians who tend to be much more, they're much more likely to be progressive in a society. We saw Gabby Gifford get shot, Joe Cox be killed. Three women in Finland were just murdered last weekend. And although there hasn't been any direct link to this, the fact is one of them was a mayor, two of them were journalists, and Finland has a very thriving connection to global white nationalist networks.
Maria says on Twitter, when Austrian friend explained laws about speech and Holocaust denial, it sounded anti-free speech. Now I'm reconsidering my opinion. Steph on the page.
David says limiting speech often has social benefits, but the problem is that it comes with great social costs too, and the social costs usually outweigh the benefits. Many ideas that we take for granted today might have been subject to government censorship once upon a time.
And Margaret, a call for you here from Eric in White Bear Lake. Hi, Eric. What are you thinking about?
Hi. So I wanted to add in one point that is a little bit off field from the current focus on legal controls, given the fact that right now a lot of our trends are breaking up power centralization from the previous 20th century trend of just like centralized government power and big brother, blah, 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 into a whole lot of different smaller organizations, little brothers, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to add in as a note for discussion, Google Jigsaw, the spinoff company under the Google umbrella that is currently trying to apply technological measures to solve social problems. They have been trying to do some work to help solve this issue of hate speech and hate speech being used by internet lynch mobs.
Okay.
And they have been working on a project called Conversation AI to use some machine learning to create online bots that would interact with web users and internet users who are specifically either engaging in extremist and hate speech rhetoric or just getting into and looking for information bubbles where white nationalists and hate speech rhetoricians tend to thrive.
So, Eric, because I'm a little short on time, I'm just going to take this back to Margaret and say, can technology be part of the answer to this? Maybe the kind of technology we're not quite using yet.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that there is a lot of good work that is being done. And there are also NGOs like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU that are working specifically with technology to accomplish that.
And Soraya, do you feel like it was the quality of the campaign rhetoric and some of the reaction to these far right and white nationalist groups to Trump's campaign and election that has brought this back into discussion, or have we needed to talk about this for longer than just this last election season?
So many of us who have been targeted by this violence for years have been talking about it and engaging with these companies and with legislators for a long time. And so, yes, this is a particular this is a very dangerous inflection point, I think. But this links actually to the last caller, which I think is making an important point. I've evaluated that Jigsaw product. It started off related to something called the Wiki Detox tool, and it speaks directly to this issue of how assessments are made and what a society's norms are. If you use that tool right now, which pretty much anybody can go and do, if you actually put in a threat, for example, you should be raped, the tool evaluates as not really an aggressive attack on a person. And you have to wonder why that is. Who's making that decision? Who's teaching the AI? What bodies of people are evaluating the original language to say that that's not a threat? Because if you actually say instead something I can't say on
the radio, actually. Mm-hmm. But if you say to a guy, you're a blank, 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 mm-hmm. it comes out as an absolute threat and an aggressive act. So tools like that incorporate biases that already exist. We know that's true in the mortgage market, in the job market, and they are reproducing them in this tool that is meant to reduce harassment, and in its current iteration will not do that. So I think it's great that they're doing that work. I think it's more important that we get to that issue of how diversity affects the creation of solutions.
Soraya, really appreciate the time and the insight. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Margaret, thank you to you very much. Good to have you here.
Thank you.